Good morning, Wabash.
Good morning, Cody.
Dr. Barreto was born in Carmagui, Cuba, and graduated from New College in Florida with a degree in economics. He received his PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1985, and he's been at Wabash since. While here, he has written a textbook on introductory econometrics with Frank Howland and spends his summers running the Opportunity to Learn About Business program. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Barreto for his chapel talk, The Star-Spangled Banner.
Thank you very much. I got to tell you, I think this idea sounded a lot better in the shower where I had it than it does right now. I'm thinking this might not work, but it's a little too late to back up, so we'll just kind of do what we were going to do and see what happens. I'm going to kind of tell you some stories about my childhood, and one thing that I want you to know just before we get going is that everything that I'm going to tell you to the best of my memory is true. Even some of these stories are going to sound really fantastic and weird, but that's the way I remember them. That's the way I think things really shook out. I'm not going to have anything really deep, important to say. I'm really not. I don't know the meaning of life, and I don't know why bad things happen to good people. But there may be some connections here, and I'm not going to kind of connect all these dots for you. I'm hoping that maybe you can do a little bit of that and just kind of see what my perspective on growing up and how things went for me. So basically, what happened was I was listening to NPR, and they had this segment on the Star-Spangled Banner and this new version, and it made me think of my childhood and a Star-Spangled Banner that I heard when I was a little kid. And so that's basically what's going to tie all this together, is going to be the Star-Spangled Banner, and I'm gonna kind of dull the monotony a little bit by playing a couple versions of it. So that'll give us a chance to kind of take a break. But let's get started. So I need to do this like Google Maps thing where, you know, we zoom in. Okay, so we're gonna zoom in on October 7th, 1968. October 7th, 1968. And we're zooming in on Miami, and we're zooming in on West Miami. My address is 7911 Southwest 15th Street. And we've moved there just a year or two ago. We used to live in a place in Miami much closer to the heart of Miami, and it was called Pastorita. Pastorita is what the Cubans called this little enclave. It was a set of apartment buildings, and we used to live, my family lived in a two-bedroom apartment for several years, from 1962 when we arrived in Miami, all the way to like 65, 66. It was kind of the sleeping arrangements were kind of tight. My mom and dad had one bedroom, my two sisters had another bedroom, and then there were four boys in the living room. So we did that for a while, if you can imagine that. So now it's October 7th, 1968, and it's a Monday morning, and things are getting ready, people are getting ready to go to school, but I'm in bed and I'm moaning. I'm a really cute little kid, not at all what I look like now. It's really cute, and I'm moaning, and I'm just moaning up a storm. And my mom comes in, and I say, you know, oh, me duele la garganta. My throat is killing me, you know. And she's just looking at me, and she goes, all right, well, we'll get a thermometer. So thermometers are like special. They're a symbol in my house. Thermometers were what my dad first sold when we got to the United States. The way he made money is he would go around and sell stuff to people. I mean, this sounds like incredible, right? Okay, this business model is unreal. He'll sell you clothes, jewelry, I mean, you name it, he'll sell it, but he'll go to your house and he'll deliver the goods, and then you pay him back a little bit at a time. So if he sells you a dress for $20, then you only give him $5, and he has all these books, these little black kind of ledgers, and they have the days of the week on the spines. And then the kids, we balance the books for him, okay? And we write down if somebody paid $5, now they only owe 15. There's no interest, that's way too complicated, right? My dad's business model's really simple. Anything he buys, he'll go to the Miami Garment District and buy this dress for $10. And then he'll turn around and he'll double it. Everything's 100%, and he'll sell it for $20, and then he'll charge you $5 installments over 4 months. He'll recollect, over 4 weeks, he'll get his money back. But he always wants you to have a balance. It's just like a, kind of a Visa card without all the complications of the percentage rate and all that other stuff, okay? It's a brilliant plan. It requires incredible work. My dad works like a beast. He works from 6 a.m. to 10 at night. Works all the time. Sundays are his half days. He comes home around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. So my mom has given me the thermometer and checked it. And the reason why the thermometer was such an important first sale was he realized when we first got here that nobody could tell whether their kid had a temperature or not because all the thermometers were in Fahrenheit scale. And so he found some thermometers that were Fahrenheit and centigrade. And then he started selling those, and people were just buying those like hotcakes. So that was really what got him going there. So my mom says, "You don't have a fever. There's nothing wrong with you." Okay. Of course, all of this is in Spanish, right? And I'm not going to let this go. I'm going to keep moaning. I'm going to keep whining. I'm even willing to get a toque. Okay. Now I know you have no idea what this could possibly be. What's a toque? So here's the deal. You ready? There's this product called Gentian Violet. You can actually go to a drugstore. It's hard to find, but you can find it. If you take, and this is what we used to do when we were little, mom would take a lead pencil and put some cotton at the end of it, dunk it in this purple liquid, and then make you go, like that, and then dab, paint the back of your throat with this purple stuff. And it will cure this bacterial infection. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this stuff sells in the United States with skull and crossbones on it. It says for external use only. And then she tells you, don't swallow. Don't swallow this stuff. Absolutely not. You will not. And then you go to school, and your face is completely purple, because that's one of the stuff that stains like you wouldn't believe. There are pencils all over our house with purple on them. And, it's amazing, okay? And then the American kids go, what the hell happened to you? I mean, why is your face purple? And you say, because I got toque. Everybody knows that. What is wrong with you? Okay, so I'm willing to take a toque. I'm willing to do anything because I got to stay home. My dad comes in and he goes, ¿Qué pasa aquí? What's going on here, right? Comes into the bedroom. And my dad, when I was a little kid, I thought my dad was the sternest, strictest man on the planet. My dad was really tough as nails. As I've mentioned, worked like you would not believe. Can you imagine taking your family, 6 children ages 2 to 14, and bringing them to the United States? Kind of gives you a feel for it, with no money whatsoever. One of my dad's favorite stories is one of my brothers, when we got off the plane in Miami in July of 1961, when we got off that plane, 62, my brother had stuffed some cash in his shoe. My brother was like 6. My brother Jose had stuffed some cash. And he when he got off the plane, my dad said, what do we do now? And my brother whips out some cash from his shoe and says, I've got some cash. And my dad was like, why did you do that? That was incredibly dangerous. Like if the police had caught you, we wouldn't have been able to leave. You weren't allowed to take anything. You were basically allowed to take the clothes on your back. And my brother said, well, yeah, I know, but they're not going to check a little kid, I got this figured out, okay? It's not a problem. And here's the cash. And my dad goes, great, all right, give me the cash. I mean, we could use the cash. So when we got here, by the way, just as another kind of aside, I'm still moaning, by the way, right, in bed. This is really, I'm a great actor. When we got there, there were only 5 of us, my 3 oldest brothers and sisters. They had been sent ahead 9 months earlier. They were part of something called Operation Peter Pan. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that in here before, but that was this thing between the United States government and the Catholic Church, where they took 14,000 children out of Cuba in the couple of years between 1960 and 1961, around in there. There were these rumors flying around that the Cuban government was going to start taking kids out of their homes and raise them communally. And some people said that Che was like into this. Che was this really committed, kind of fanatical ideologue. I'll talk more about him in a little bit. But But other people say it was the CIA, that they planted these stories, and that the government really, there were no real plans to do this. But this actual event did occur. 14,000 children were separated from their families, were brought to the United States. My three oldest brothers and sisters were sent to New Mexico. They were separated, put in three different foster homes for 9 months. And then in July of 62, we were all reunited back in Miami. So that was pretty big. I don't remember that at all. I was only 2 years old, so I don't remember that. But it was pretty impressive. So with that background, you're ready to hear, I think, I hope you're curious about why I was faking so much, what was going on. And, you know, why I was faking sickness, why I couldn't go to school. Maybe somebody's going to beat me up. I mean, I don't know. It wasn't that at all. See, what happened was I really, really, really wanted to see a baseball game. Wanted to see the Cardinals-Tigers Game 5. And I was a huge baseball fan. I was a huge Cardinal fan. And so what happened was I decided that I had to fake being sick so that I could see the game, because at that time the games were all at 1 o'clock. They were all in the afternoon. First night World Series game wasn't until 1971. Okay? So what would happen is, like, I missed Game 1. Game 1, Bob Gibson struck out 17 Tigers and set a World Series record. It's still a record. And I missed almost all of it because, well, I mean, I have to run home from school. I mean, I jump on my bike, I avoid bullies or whatever. I remember being kind of, you know, really smart, because I thought, I won't lock my bike. That way I can just jump on my bike and go incredibly fast, just ride home as fast as I can. And by the time I get home, the game's almost over. You know, my school ends at 3. It's ridiculous. I get home at 3:16 or something like that. I'm toast, right? So I figure I got to do this sickness thing. So my mom says, you know, tells my dad he's faking. Send him to school, right? And my dad kind of looks at me. I remember one of my brothers saying, you better get up, or, you know, Pop's going to kick your ass if you don't get up, okay? And I was like, oh, man, come on. And, you know, you never know. And I'm praying like crazy. I'm just praying. And my dad walks in, and, you know, he says, ¿Qué pasa aquí? My mom says he's faking. And he looks at me, and he says, déjalo tranquilo. He says, just leave him alone. And walks out. Tells my mom, leave him alone, he can stay. I couldn't believe it. I thought it was like a miracle. I mean, this was just straight like somebody walking on water. It was unreal. I thought this prayer thing it works. There's no doubt about it, okay? I'm really into this, okay? Wow, so unbelievable. So I'm now at home, and, you know, I get to sort of waste time. My mom's going to make me lunch. And I guess eventually I'm going to be able to see this baseball game, which is great, okay? But before I see the baseball game, let me just tell you a little bit more about this whole kind of why my family left, just to make sure you're not too confused. I want to say some things about language here in just a little bit, and just to let you know what my take is. To me, language is just a tremendous barrier. It's a really serious barrier. And I watched my parents struggle with language, and it really made an impression on me. But we could start a long, long time ago. But let's start in 1953. That's July 26, 1953. That's when Fidel Castro, he was born in 1926, so he's 27 years old. He attacks a military installation, okay? A couple hundred men. He tries to overrun a barracks, Moncada. These barracks, and he's ratted out by one of his friends or whatever, the Batista. The army knows he's coming, and so it's a mess, and they shoot many of his people, and they capture about 100 people, and then they try him, okay? They actually put him in a court and try him. Turns out he's a lawyer, and he represents all these other people, and he gets a bunch of them off. He's apparently a brilliant defense lawyer, and he also manages to take the stand in his own defense, and he gives this like 6-hour talk on why he has the moral authority to attack the government, okay? And later on, it wasn't actually transcribed, but later on he kind of works, he tells somebody else the story or tells them the speech or whatever, and some people say he actually did this while he was in prison, so it's sort of a prison literature kind of thing, I'm not sure. But it is a book, and it's called History Will Absolve Me. That's his last line in his 6-hour, he's a master at extemporaneous speaking, right? So it's 6 hours kind of diatribe, and he ends it with, La historia me absolverá, and that's the that's the title of the book. And it's in the Wabash College Library, and you can get it online. You can just Google History Will Absolve Me, and you will hit it right away if you want to see something about what Castro was saying at that time. But so then he's put in jail, and then in 1955 there's a general amnesty, and he gets out, and he goes to Mexico, and that's where he meets Che. He meets Che Guevara in Mexico and becomes his friend, and they come up with this plan to invade Cuba. And it's another fiasco where the Batista government knows he's coming. He's on this boat. The ship is called Granma, and that's the name of the Cuban national newspaper now, Granma. Okay, but only a few survive, and they make it in the mountains. And then the story unfolds where he gives these speeches, and he gets the peasants on his side, and you know, eventually he takes over. It was a big surprise when he takes over. Batista leaves on New Year's Eve, 1958. So Castro's in Havana in 1959, January 1, 1959. He's the leader of the country, and he's 33 years old. Okay. And he's got ideas about land reform and some other things, but Che has got some other even more intense ideas about sort of communism and reorganizing the economy. And so lots of things happen. Castro announces in 1961 that he's a Marxist-Leninist. And that's a big deal, but my parents still decide not to leave then. But then this news about whether they're going to put kids in camps and graze them communally or whatever, that was the straw that broke the camel's back for my parents, and I think for lots of other people, and that's what had them, that's why they left, okay? So that's how I got into the United States, and that's how I'm now faking sickness, and that's how I'm now able to watch the Detroit Tigers and the St. Louis Cardinals, and the game is now being played, and it's really not good for the Cardinals, not good at all. Cardinals lose, and Lou Brock fails to slide, and this is a big deal. This is a big mistake, and they're going to lose. They were up 3-1, so that's why I really wanted to fake sickness, because I figured this could be it. You know, they were going to win, but in fact they lose, and wow. So they lose game 6. They lose game 7. The Tigers have this pitcher named Mickey Lolich, and oh my goodness, and then it's all a big mess. Okay, so that didn't work out very well, but you know, that's not why the game's really famous in my mind. The game's famous because of what happened on the field, I guess, but there's something else special that happened that day. The Tigers, the game was played in Detroit, and Ernie Harwell had agreed to have this guy named Jose Feliciano sing the national anthem that day, okay? And it turns out that he had this quirky version, and Harwell had never heard it, but he figured, okay, let's have him do it. So I'm watching TV, and Kurt Gowdy, he's the announcer, Kurt Gowdy says, "And now let's turn our attention to center field, where Jose Feliciano will sing our national anthem." And there's this guy out there with a guide dog. He was blind, and he is blind. And he's got a guitar, and he's going to start playing this song. And I guess I want you to hear the song, see what you think. Okay, you ready? Here comes Jose Feliciano with the Star Spangled Banner. Okay, so after he saying that, Kurt Gowdy didn't say a word. They cut to commercial. I've been trying to find video of this, but I can't find it. But I swear that's how I remember it. He didn't say anything. You know how they usually go in, we'll be right back with the start of today's game. Didn't happen. Okay, Ernie Harwell, the Tiger switchboard, lit up. NBC was deluged. People were incensed. They were out of their minds. Okay, they were really angry. I don't know if you're angry about it. I mean, you've heard so many versions. After this happens, Jimi Hendrix does this thing with his guitar. Oh my God, if you want to hear the Star Spangled Banner, Jimi Hendrix, psychedelic rock, just Google that, okay? But, you know, Marvin Gaye, just all people just go nuts with the Star Spangled Banner. But Jose Feliciano was the first one to sing a non-standard version, okay? And it caused a tremendous uproar. I went to school the next day, and my teacher said that was un-American. What he did was un-American, and I said, I thought it was different. I kind of think difference good. I'm really not a big fan of conformity. I like difference. I think we should celebrate it. And that wasn't flying at all. There was nobody who was buying any of that, okay? Zero. I thought maybe part of it had to do with language, right? I mean, maybe that was it. I don't know. Again, I have another book recommendation for you. Richard Rodriguez, Hunger of Memory. When I read that book in the early 80s, I thought, hey, that's exactly what happened to me. I mean, Richard Rodriguez is a Mexican, and he describes how at home he only spoke Spanish, and that was his private voice, but then he had a public voice. I mean, the separation for me was complete. I would always speak Spanish at home, and I would only speak English out, right? Sometimes the worlds would collide with sometimes funny consequences. I'm sitting home one day, and I'm a little kid, and it was 7:30 or 8 o'clock, and somebody knocks on the door, and it's the person collecting for the newspaper. So I'm here to collect for the Miami Herald, you owe me $3 or whatever. So I'm like, papi, tiene que pagar por el periódico. So he comes over, my dad comes over, and I'm going to translate for him now. And he says, tell the guy that I already paid it. So I do. And the guy says, well, he's got this big O ring with these kind of things on there, and you punch out when people have paid. He says, you haven't paid. I don't have a record of you having paid. So I explained that to my dad. You know, my dad says, I sent this check. Tell him that. And I said, he sent it. And, you know, we do this for a while. And my dad's starting to lose it. At one point, the guy says something like, I can't remember exactly what he said, but it was something like, you know, you people ought to pay your debt or something. Or I'm going to cancel your subscription if you don't pay. So I turn around and I tell my dad, he says he's going to cancel his subscription. So my dad looks at me and says, and I can see he's starting to lose it. He's really starting to lose it. And he looks at me and he goes, dile que se meta el dedo en el culo. And I go, okay. I'm like 7 or 8 years old, okay? I turn around and I look at this guy and I go, my father says he's extremely displeased with this turn of events. He's absolutely displeased. Suddenly, I feel my whole body being jerked, turned completely around. My dad's grabbed me by the shoulders, and he's looking at me, and he is ballistic. And he says, that's not what I told you to tell him. Tell him exactly what I told you to tell him. And so I look at this man, you know, kind of tall up there, and I go, my dad says that you have to stick your finger up your asshole. I'm sorry I had to say that here, but I had no choice. I had no choice. It was unbelievable. And then he just launched, and, you know, there's this tremendous screaming. My dad had one cuss word that he loves, Saramam Beach. He thought son of a bitch was one word, Sarambitch. He used that a lot. He just started unloading on this guy with this word. I was like, oh my gosh. Wow. I'll tell you a better story, a more religiously uplifting story if you want one of those. My mom's side, I have an uncle who's a priest and two aunts that are nuns. And when we first came to the United States, we used to go to their kind of convent. I used to like to go there because they give me candy, so that was kind of fun, okay? But my family was really going there to get clothing and for my dad to do a few odd and end jobs to get some money, really. We went there one day and there were all these police officers there. And, you know, we're trying to figure out what's going on. And we go in there, and what's happened is that someone's tried to rob the nuns. Now, I don't know if you know Eddie Murphy, but he had a riff for years ago where somebody was trying to shoot the Pope, and he said, you know, that person's going straight to hell. You can just bypass everyone. If you try to shoot the Pope, it's because you want to go to hell really fast, okay? I mean, are you kidding me? How do you rob nuns? I mean, this is, like, sick. You know, these people have a vow of poverty. They don't have anything. But the deal is this guy's got some stuff, and he's at the top of the stairs, and he's running down the stairs, and the Mother Superior is waiting for him at the bottom of the stairs. Okay, and the Mother Superior is waiting down there. And when the guy gets down there, she says to him, I think this is one of the great lines of all time in my book. She says, is there anything else I can get you? What do you think? Come on. You know, it's like, I'll help you take whatever you want out of here. That's pretty good. I don't know. I'm still in my bedroom, I guess. I've seen the game. Everything's great. I've argued with people afterwards, and everybody's mad at Feliciano. Some people want to deport him, which makes no sense because he's Puerto Rican, so I don't know where the hell you're going to deport him to. Then Tommy Smith and John Carlos, that happens. That's amazing, right? With the protests of the national anthem. Again, I've always liked difference. Think about Muhammad Ali. I liked him. I like Dennis Rodman. I don't know, maybe that helps you to understand what's going on here. I don't know. So let's listen to the next version of the national anthem. You ready? The next one's going to be the one that triggered this whole event, that triggered this, you know, all these memories in my mind about the national anthem. This is El Himno Nacional.
Latinos, Latinas. Papá,
amanecer, lo ves a la luz de la aurora, lo que tanto aclamamos, la noche al caer, sus estrellas,
enseñar
So once again, same effect, tremendous uproar. And can you believe an uproar over something like this? I mean, there's war, there's the economy, there's a lot of other things going on, but a lot of people are very upset about this, and I don't know, maybe they think, you know, singing this song in Spanish or whatever, somehow thumbing your nose at people who speak English. I guess I just really don't see it that way. I was in the bank. This is Crawfordsville, Indiana, 5-7 years ago, something like that. And there was this guy in front of me, and he obviously was having a tough time figuring out what was going on. And he was Mexican, and I said, yeah, can I help? Can you explain what's happening? And he says, I'm trying to cash this check, and she's only giving me $30, and it's a $70 check. And so I asked the teller, so what's going on? She says, he doesn't have an account here, so there's like a $35 fee to cash this check. And I said, oh, that's ridiculous. How about if he just signs it over to me, and I'll just give him the money? And she was like kind of frustrated, and she's like, sure, yeah, that's right, okay, fine. So I just explained it to the guy, and he's like, okay. And so, you know, we do this. I give him the $70, he walks away. And he was really kind of thankful, and, you know, it was an easy thing for me to do. And then I go to do my transaction, and she says something like, you know, I wish these people would learn to speak English or something, I don't know. And I kind of was like, wow, all right, so have you ever traveled outside of the United States? She said, no, and I said, you know, you really should. Once you go to another country, and you can't communicate with people, and you realize that it's not that you're stupid, because I don't think that guy was stupid. It's not that at all. It's not like he can snap his fingers and get the language, because if he could, he would. Right? I mean, my parents, they struggled mightily to learn English. My mom would go to these night classes. And then as a little kid, I would try to, like, coach her. It was ridiculous. Okay? I mean, bow. You bow to the king and you put a bow on a ribbon. How do you explain those two words? And what about the bow on the tree? And what about through and rough? Where's the pattern? What exactly is O-U-G-H? I mean, what does it do? You know? I mean, there's nothing like that in Spanish. There's nothing like O-U-G-H that just you slap these letters together and they can make like 17,000 different sounds. It's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. When students come to my office and they're like, oh, I gotta take Spanish, it's really hard. I'm like, are you kidding me? Please, you know? It's like, that's nonsense, okay? I mean, it's hard, yeah, to acquire a language is hard, but English, my goodness. They're not learning English because they are trying to thumb their nose at you or something, and, you know, that doesn't make any sense, right? It's just really, really hard to acquire the language, and language is a barrier. But once you can acquire it, you can do a lot with it, obviously. I don't know what I was thinking when I said I would do this talk and whether this has worked at all. I have no idea. When I heard that Star Spangled Banner story on NPR, and you can go and listen to the whole story and listen to whatever Francis Scott Key's great-great-great-grandson whine about, whatever his deal is about the ownership of the English version of the national anthem. I mean, it's a silly story, but it just makes me think of so many other things, ways that language impacts our lives. And that's kind of what I wanted to share with you. I do have one last thing to say, and it's kind of a rough segue, but I hope it does make a little bit of sense. It turns out that I'm going to be leaving Wabash at the end of the semester. And I just kind of wanted to let you know that. I've struggled over the years, and increasingly so, with the fact that Wabash discriminates against women in admissions, and I can't do it here anymore under those kinds of circumstances. I know that many of you disagree with me on that, and that's okay. But I did want to just let you know that I'm pretty full of myself, but I know I'm not irreplaceable. I know there will be somebody in my office and teaching economics classes, you know, in September. And I'm guessing that replacement won't be as anti-all male as I am. And here's the one thing that I really kind of want to say is, you'd think, and this is maybe I'm speaking specifically now to somebody who is like rabidly all male, okay? We're talking cult. Well, I'm into this big time, okay? Okay, so listen to exactly what I'm going to tell you, because I think this is really important. You might think at first blush that replacing me with somebody who is sort of more in tune, more on board with the mission of the college is a good thing. But I think that's really dead wrong. I think that's like always singing the national anthem the same way. I think you really want people to challenge you. I think you really want people that think differently than you and to tell you that they think differently. I think you want people to be honest with you and transparent. And I think those are very important qualities. So beware the people who just stand up there and just cheer three cheers for, you know, old Wabash, everything's great all the time. Beware that. And I guess I just want to say thank you very much for coming out to listen to me, and have a great day. Thank you.